Welcome to Coastal Cafe. I'm Aaron Barnett, your host today. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington, College of the Environment, and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Today we have a very special tribal perspective on the Kalisu Harbor Restoration Project. You can correct me if I pronounce it wrong later on, you guys, but I'd like to introduce Randy Johnston from the Jamestown Skellum Tribe, Hans Daubenberger from the Port Gamble Skellum Tribe, and Rebecca Benjamin from the North Olympic Salmon Coalition. Welcome to Coastal Cafe. I'd like to start with you, Hans. I believe you have a tribal recognition you'd like to speak on.
Yeah, I just wanted to start this off by talking about the place and the name associated with that place. And for the Port Gamble Skellum people, the place is known, and I will do my best to pronounce this, and that word means a passage through, and it is regarded as a place where people moved between Killisett Harbor. They used that channel to navigate between Killisett Harbor and Oak Bay, and they would use it as a fishing location. In Killisett Harbor in 1884, there was a fisheries report produced for the U.S. government, and it specifically called out the smelt resource that was located in Killisett Harbor and how Native people harvested those resources there. And so I just wanted to kind of start off with that note of what that place meant to the indigenous people in the area.
Well, thank you very much. I think our listeners will be really appreciative to hear that. So I'd like to start off with Randy. And Randy, could you talk about the project and the history of the project that we're going to be talking about in more detail in the next few minutes?
In 1974, a local person, John Taylor, wrote a letter to the Washington Department of Fisheries describing a kill of small Dungeness crabs, cockles, and sand dollars along his shoreline property on the east side of the southern end of Killisett Harbor. By 1975, this report had made its way to the Department of Ecology, and they sent an inspector up to see what was going on. And they found that there was no problem with fecal coliform, but there was a lot of dead sea life. And the Department of Ecology inspector concluded that there was no tidal exchange occurring between Killisett Harbor and Oak Bay, and as it once had. And this was attributed to the fact that bridges, which had previously gone across the tidal channels, had been replaced first with one set of culverts and then later with a smaller set of culverts. And these culverts were not allowing enough tidal flow to go back and forth to keep the channels open, and it had shoaled over. And now Killisett Harbor had become a cul-de-sac with poor flushing. And ecology recommended at the time that these culverts should be removed and a bridge should be put back in to allow tidal flushing to occur for the benefit of water quality in Killisett Harbor. The Port Angeles Daily News reported on this in December of 1975. And it's interesting that the county engineer of the time, Ed Becker, commented that this matter had actually been brought to the county's attention several times in recent years, but nothing had been done. He said, but the pressure in the future will be great enough that the county government will have to consider restoration of the channels and construction of the bridges. That was December of 75. Eventually, the county turned the road over to the state, but nothing was done. In 2010, the Jamestown Skellum Tribe learned that the Navy was going to be doing a couple of different projects that would require some mitigation. And a word had gone out among the staff at the Jamestown Skellum Tribe, well, what kind of mitigation could potentially occur? What would be a good project? And reconnection of Killisett Harbor was mentioned. And the tribe was pretty enthusiastic that that seemed like a worthy thing to do to not only improve water quality for shellfish and other aquatic life in Killisett Harbor, but to also restore the marine migration corridor for salmon and other fish and even marine mammals that once used to exist there. This happened to be at a time when the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Corps of Engineers were collaborating on a process called the Puget Sound Nearshore Restoration Project, PISNR for short. I happen to have known some of the folks working on that. I contacted them and said, hey, we got a great project up here that I would like you to look at. And at that time, PISNRP was scoping out and designing projects, nearshore restoration projects. They came up, they looked at it, they liked it, they wrote up a characterization report. Then by spring of 2011, they had actually produced a design report. The tribe was hopeful that potentially the Navy would fix this problem as a mitigation project, and the tribe made a presentation to the Navy in 2011. We were also hopeful that perhaps the PISNR process might bring some money in for construction. That didn't happen. We approached the Washington Department of Transportation, which had an injunction brought against them for fish blocking culverts, which we said these were. And this was 2013 by then, and Ponce was involved in that conversation. A number of folks were, Port Gamble tribe, along with the Jamestown Squalums. And then I think what really made the difference is that also in 2012, I believe it was, Rebecca Benjamin's noble organization, the North Olympic Salmon Coalition, decided they were going to take this thing on, this huge project. And they did. They began a series of grants and studies and designs. And ultimately, they built the thing. And I didn't really have much to do with it after the Salmon Coalition took over. But it was a really great outcome. And I'm really thankful to Rebecca and her team for having finished the deal.
Well, that leads me to ask Rebecca about the North Olympic Salmon Coalition's initial involvement, and could you comment on your experiences with the project and what you've learned and what you've gained out of it?
We started working on the project when we realized that the PISNR process wasn't moving very fast and that this had been languishing since the 70s. And as Randy said, we started advancing some grant proposals, and we found a lot of success with that. And so it wasn't enough to start pulling money together, but then we had to work to build the partnerships and open dialogue with the landowners and the infrastructure owner to be able to start partnering toward the feasibility of actually doing the project. The Navy owns the majority of the land where the new bridge was built. There's also private land ownership. And the Washington State Department of Transportation owns the road. And so by far, the biggest lift was getting the Navy to say yes to allowing this project to happen. And as Randy alluded to, they had mitigation needs. And ultimately, it was the cooperation of the area tribes to consent that this project could be mitigation for other Navy actions in the region. And so that gave the project the green light it needed to move forward. And then working with Department of Transportation also was really challenging. And it was ultimately, I think, that the Department of Fish and Wildlife took a really unprecedented step to call this fish passage culvert a blockage. And it was really unusual because usually we think of fish passage problems on rivers, but this one is marine water to marine water. But the reality is all of the fish to the south of us in Puget Sound and Hood Canal have an opportunity to migrate through Killisett Harbor and its excellent habitat. So having that listed as a fish problem kind of gave the Department of Transportation a little bit more pressure because of the culvert injunction to actually work with us to replace this causeway with a bridge.
What were the salmon runs like in Killisa Harbor before the causeway, the culverts went in?
This is Han. So in 2009, the Port Gamble Sklom tribe started a research project to look at juvenile salmon outmigration through North Hood Canal, Admiralty Inlet, and to the eastern straits of Juan de Fuca. And we were interested in sort of how fish moved, where they went, what kind of habitats were the most valuable to them, how quickly did they migrate. And we looked at juvenile Chinook, juvenile chum salmon, juvenile coho, and pink salmon. And we were quite surprised in our research that fish tended to move. Once they entered the marine water, they would move relatively quickly to places that had high abundances of zooplankton or larval forage fish and other types of productive prey items. So if the things that are really important to salmon are that they have food and that they can grow quickly during their early out-migration period. And so the prey resources they depend on are kind of larval fish, insect fallout from native vegetation and flowering plants that produce a lot of insects that land on the water surface, and zooplankton. And what we found were that the large embayment in North Hood Canal and in Killisette Harbor had some of the most productive habitat. We sampled zooplankton, we sampled for larval fish, we sampled for insect fallout, and we found that Port Gamble Bay, Port Ludlow, and Killisette Harbor had some of the most productive prey resources available for juvenile salmon. And we saw that in places where fish weren't impeded, like Port Gamble Bay and Port Ludlow, there are really high abundances of Chinook salmon out-migrating, Chinook salmon, chum salmon, pink salmon, coho salmon, all use those habitats. In Killisette Harbor, we found those fish, but they were mostly up near the north end where the entrance, the only entrance into Killisette Harbor existed, and the numbers were relatively few. On top of that, the water quality conditions in the southern part of the Killisette Harbor, once you get into July and August, which is the time period where we would see juvenile Chinook salmon migrating, that southern end of Killisette Harbor would reach temperatures around 70 degrees Fahrenheit, which is quite stressful for juvenile salmon. They need cooler water than that. So basically, what we saw were a lot of fish building up on the Oak Bay side of where the now entrance is to Killisette Harbor. And those fish were basically having to choose between going through Admiralty Inlet, which is a fairly deep and rocky habitat, or going through the Port Townsend Canal, which once you enter Port Townsend Bay, there's pretty good habitat there. But the canal itself is riprapped and a pretty, well, it's a man-made channel. It has a lack of complexity and habitat for juvenile fish, and therefore is a pretty difficult place for fish to migrate without being preyed upon by marine mammals. So anyway, that I guess the gist of the answer to your question, the short answer is there are a lot fewer fish in Killisette Harbor than we saw in places that had the same kind of high quality habitat. And we just started sampling there again last week, and we're already seeing large numbers of chum. And for the first time ever, we've sampled coho salmon in Killisette Harbor. So we're pretty excited.
So if you're just joining us, this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. I'm Aaron Barnett, today's host of Coastal Cafe, and we're speaking with Rebecca Benjamin, Randy Johnson, Hans Dobenberger, by the Killisette Harbor Restoration Project, which, if you're not familiar with, was the removal of a causeway between Indian and Marrowstone Island and replaced with a bridge. And so I guess this question might go back to you again, Hans. So what specifically are you finding since the causeway was removed that addressed those things? Like, what kind of temperature differences have you seen in the southern end of the harbor?
We sampled temperature right after the causeway was opened, that literally, I think it was within days. And the temperature went from 68 degrees Fahrenheit the day before the causeway was opened to 50 3 degrees Fahrenheit. So a 15 degree change in that immediate vicinity happened relatively quickly. And then progressively over time, the bay, that kind of southern end of the bay, sort of mixed more. And we saw just kind of a sustained lower temperature in that part of the bay. So that was pretty exciting from a water quality standpoint. We're just starting our sampling for this season, so we don't have results at this point for some of the other parameters that we monitor, like chlorophyll, salinity. Well, we don't expect a big change in salinity, but we do think that we'll see a pretty significant shift in temperature, in turbidity, and chlorophyll.
That leads me to my next question, which I'm not sure who could answer, but are there any specific predictions that you guys see for species of salmon, numbers of salmon, time frame out of this project? Like, what do you see down the road for the species type and numbers of salmon that will hopefully head back into this area?
It's a pretty difficult thing to guess at, but I expect this to be a very important rearing habitat for juvenile fish. That access point is open to any fish migrating out of Puget Sound, including the Hood Canal, and even fish that are coming out of the Wooden Basin through the south end. We see that general area is just really, really full of productivity in fish, and having access to it, we expect to see increased survival in those juvenile fish as they out-migrate. I don't think that we can, really, really difficult to predict, you know, what one project will do to future adult populations, returning adults. But this was probably one of the more important projects in Puget Sound. It's one of the biggest opening, you know, reconnections or reestablishing habitat that's really feasible in Puget Sound. If you think of the other places where we've lost habitat, the cost and lift that would be required to restore those places is so much more significant. If you think of, for instance, Port Townsend waterfront was almost entirely a wetland complex or an estuary, you know, kind of a wetland complex. And that is gone, and it probably can't be reestablished. In greater Puget Sound, you know, we have the railroad system that kind of runs along the east side of Puget Sound, and it's very difficult to do anything in the near shore that kind of is at this scale. There just aren't that many other projects out there. So we're really hopeful that there'll be a significant change in adult returns as a result of this project.
Was this a historically significant fishing area for the tribes?
It was. It was historically significant, though, mostly for forage fish. So it's a very important place for fishing for smelt. Sandlance and herring all spawn in Tillicet Harbor, but smelt, there was a tribal fishery for smelt that was a very important fishery in Tillicet Harbor. And it's the larval fish, so basically the baby smelt, that are so important to juvenile Chinook salmon, and is why we think this opening this habitat up is going to really help juvenile Chinook particularly grow rapidly as they migrate out to the ocean.
That's interesting. I'm not a fisheries expert, so I didn't make the connection, which leads me to my next question. For our reader's benefit, if somebody could quickly describe what forage fish is. I mean, you know, I think we can infer from the name forage or what they're for, but if somebody could elaborate on that for a minute, I think our readers would be appreciative.
Generally, forage fish, we think of thirst smelt, sand lance, herring, but basically they're fish that are key to the survival of larger, you know, kind of they're like a stepping stone in the food chain in the ocean. They're a really critical part of transferring energy from the lower food web, kind of the zooplankton level, up to the larger marine mammals and large fish like salmon.
Looking down the road, how do you guys gauge when this project will end?
As far as completion of the project, it's an end and a beginning is the way that I think of it. We've completed the human intervention piece where we've taken out the causeway and we've put in a bridge and we've excavated out all of the sediment that accumulated over time, blocking that old tidal channel that connects Oak Bay to Killisett Harbor. So all of those physical pieces are done. And the beginning is that now it's Mother Nature's turn to pick up her paintbrush and do her work. And so we now take a back seat and we watch. Hans's team is monitoring very closely the biological and physical chemical changes. And my team will be looking at physical changes. How does the tidal channel evolve over time? Does it maintain its width? Does it maintain its depth? We'll be doing that with some aerial drone surveys and some physical measurements on the ground. And we watch. And I think we did a lot of work to increase the chances of that tidal channel staying open over a long period of time. And we'll be watching that closely. As sediment moves along the shoreline and winter storms move sediment around and change the form of the beach at the mouth of the channel on the Oak Bay side, we'll be watching closely to make sure that that channel stays open, because that is the key to all of the factors, all of the benefits that we're talking about. I think the physical construction is done and it's the beginning of nature sort of running its course, and hopefully we got it right, or right enough, that this will be a self-maintaining ecosystem from here on out.
Well, thank you. We're going to be closing in a couple minutes. I'd like to open up here to any comments or any thoughts or anything anybody would like to say about the project, even on a personal level. This is your chance to really share what this means. So I'd like to start with you, Hans.
Well, for me, I guess, you know, I started working on this around 2009. You know, Randy talked about how the tribes worked on getting the Navy involved. And then myself and a colleague from the tribe, Juliana Sullivan, we worked hard on the process of getting the state to recognize it as a fish barrier, as a culvert. Mm-hmm. And I know that the day that this system opened up and the reconnection was made was an immensely emotional experience for both myself and Juliana Sullivan. We went out and watched the water flow through from Oak Bay into Killisett Harbor, and it was a pretty profound thing. There were so many points, and I know Rebecca feels the same way. There were so many moments where we questioned if this was actually going to happen. We saw the history that it had been proposed all the way back into the 70s, and it was just a very emotional moment to see that water move through. So I guess that's what I have to say.
So Randy, do you have any personal comments you'd like to add?
Less than 200 years ago, European settlers arrived on the landscape, immediately began developing things left and right, began cutting forests and driving logs down rivers, began building transportation systems and ports and diking rivers to create agricultural lands. It all made sense to them at the time. But there was an incredible amount of harm done to the aquatic ecosystems. And I don't think any of it was really intentional. It just was not well informed. And this is Killisett Harbor is a quintessential example where there had been a tidal channel connecting these two highly productive embayments. And we know that the channel existed for 200 years since it was first observed. I believe it was by George Vancouver's party in the 1700s. And bridges had been built across it, and it still functioned. And then one set of culverts was rolled into it. And apparently it still seemed to be functioning to some extent. And then the county installed even smaller culverts. And that reduced tidal energy to the point where the inlet shoaled over and this major migration corridor was lost. And it stayed lost until it was finally reopened by the North Olympic Salmon Coalition on that fateful day. And that is so rewarding to see that that such immense environmental harm can be corrected. It can be fixed.
Well, for me personally, this project is probably one of the most rewarding experiences of my professional career. It was a long, hard road to get that channel open. And I think the thing that I will never forget is going under the bridge the first time as the Oak Bay water pushed into Killisett Harbor for the first time. And several of us were on our paddle boards, our project manager, Kevin Long, and his wife, and Hans was there on his paddle board. And we were all floating on the Killisett Harbor side with that juxtaposition of that hot summer elevated temperature water in Killisett Harbor on one side of our paddle boards and that freezing cold Oak Bay water pushing in for the first time. And the sense of accomplishment and pride that all of us had in that moment is something I will always remember. And it was shared by every person who was at the project site the day that that channel was open. So many people went under that bridge on their paddleboards and their kayaks and their small boats. And everybody was beaming. It really felt like a community accomplishment. The Maristone community really understood the importance of this project. They really wanted it to happen. And they were there celebrating with us. And it was really precious. I will never forget it. And I'm proud to have been part of it.
Thank you. Thank you, Rebecca. And thank you all for joining us. This is Aaron Barnett, and you've been listening to Coastal Cafe, a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the UW College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Washington Sea Grant helps people and marine life thrive by providing research, technical expertise, and education that support the conservation of our ocean and coastlines. I'd like to thank our program director, Larry Stein, and production engineer, Jared Dufresne. And as always, a special shout out to the band QEAST for sharing their music with us at the opening and closing of this program. Thank you for listening and have a great day.